Okay, from diagnostic radiology.
Diagnostic radiology sort of mainly is the interpretation of radiographs and procedural activity that you do with and on the patient. Mm-hmm. But there are certain aspects of that that's also involved in the therapy of a patient. You mentioned a while ago a difficult case. There are so many difficult cases that it's hard to say. I'm not giving you an example. Most people don't understand. You have somebody that has a tremendous automobile wreck, fractured pelvis. They keep bleeding into the pelvis, bleeding, transfusions. It's very difficult to, the surgeons say, but I can't say it for sure, but I've heard many surgeons say, when you have bleed that's into the pelvis, it's difficult to localize when you're operate. You just get in and there's a lot of blood and hard to identify a particular vessel. Well, I and other members of my group have treated a number of these. You do an angiogram and demonstrate a diagnostic angiogram to demonstrate the vessel that's bleeding of all the vessels you have in there. You have a fractured pelvis, then you know it's leaking blood. So you see the spot that's leaking. Then you have a particular type of catheter that you can put in there on an emergency basis and stop the bleeding for a while until you get set up to do the corrective procedure for it. You stop the bleeding and then you get your other material set up, put a particular catheter in there near the site where it's bleeding and embolize it after you've measured the diameter of the vessel and where it's located, and that's and block that vessel off and control the bleeding. We've done that many times.
That's wonderful.
Vessel in the neck, your vertebral artery, are you familiar with that?
I understand what it is.
Goes up into the back of the brain. We had a patient here that had a narrowed spot in that vessel. Not as common that part of the vessel, but it's not easy to get to. But this patient's threatening to stroke in his basilar artery. One of them was blocked, and this one was narrowing, the one almost blocking. If he had, unless he had some collaterals we didn't appreciate, he could stroke also. Dr. Johns threaded a catheter all the way up into the back of the head and dilated that vessel up, and the guy did very well.
Isn't that wonderful?
That is. It's impressive to see that happen. And so many times you have people with a renal artery narrowed, their high blood pressure associated with kidney, renal artery narrowed, and we dilate those vessels. And depending on the appearance of the vessel, also put a stent in to keep it open. We've had that true when people have intestinal angina. You want angina is the pain associated with insufficient blood supply. Most people report it.
Angina pectoralis?
Yeah, right.
Chest pain.
Well, you have intestinal angina also. You have to work that out clinically. But then you do an angiogram and you see the narrowing of something like spermatic artery and celiac axis artery. And there's just not enough blood getting out of the aorta to supply the intestinal tract. Maybe they have pain after eating.
Hmm.
So if you can dilate those up and save a surgical procedure. Same is true in the legs. You can dilate all pelvic vessels. Some people have claudication, intermittent claudication, pain on walking, stop and rest, it gets better. So that means there's insufficient blood supply. Take care of that vessel, the muscle, with exertion, and you can open that up. Sometimes have a major clot, just a tremendous clot in the artery, and there are enzymes you can get to dissolve the clot.
After you've located it.
After you've located it. You do that diagnostic study first, always. Mm-hmm. Then you locate that.
Well, that's fascinating.
And these are things that might happen around any hour, 24 hours a day. our group has people on call to do all aspects of diagnostic radiology 24 hours a day.
That's wonderful.
It is. And therapy is hyperthyroidism with Miss Imago. You give a different dose if they're hyperthyroid because you want to slow the activity down. Yes, guys in our group would do that.
Well, you've spoken a great deal about the exciting aspects of your career in medicine. What have been some of the most frustrating aspects?
Well, the frustrating aspect, I guess, is some of the things that are happening now as far as government regulations and so on about reimbursement from insurance carriers, Medicare, and control of medicine. Also, people doing things, it's going to sound like sour grapes now, but you see people doing things that should be in your specialty that's not.
You mean a non-specialist trying to...
Well, maybe a specialist in whatever he does, but he may be doing things that could be done better by somebody in your specialty.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of frustrating. Some folks you see practicing medicine, whether it be radiology or whether it be medicine or surgery or whatever, you feel like they're less less the typical practitioner used to be from years ago as far as being conscientious with the patient. That may sound like a sour grape thing. I don't want it to be that.
I've heard it from other people.
Doctors are not personable. But I guess it doesn't make any difference if it's personal or not if they give you good care. But it does mean a lot to the patient if you can be cordial and not just a minute that they're the liver or the kidney or something that you're taking care of. I can tell you an example that the patients have changed when they say, well, I want to change the blank person because I was going to see so-and-so. And so when they came in the room, they kept their hand on the doorknob, like they're just trying to get out of the room when they first come in. They don't listen. That's what I hear from a lot of patients.
The healthcare provider.
The healthcare provider doesn't listen.
Hmm.
As much as the patient feels like. Patients like to talk to their doctors. Now, there's some problems about why doctors don't have as much time as they should. The reimbursement rate for various insurances can't justify an hour visit for everybody that only needs maybe 10 minutes.
Physically needs 10 minutes.
Yeah, physically needs 10 minutes. But they would like to talk an hour.
Mm-hmm.
If they had an opportunity. Well, if they did that, they couldn't see enough patients to pay their...
The light bills.
Yeah, the light bill. The nursing bill. And I guess I appreciate it nowadays because I like to see these nice offices, the air conditioning that didn't used to be, nurses, technical personnel everywhere going here and there and doing their lab work and so on. Somebody has to pay those bills. A janitor comes in at night and cleans the office up. Very nice furniture in the waiting room. All these expenses are added up that sometimes patients don't understand, especially if they're older patients. They used to go into old Dr. Jones that used to see me for $10 or something. Which reminds me, my office call was $3.
So if they came to the office, it was $3. If you had to visit them at home,
five.
Such a bargain. Such a bargain.
Well, it might have been a bargain price-wise, but you'd really rather see them in the office. You can do a better job in the office.
Surely.
But I I did all right with that. You have to see a lot of patients at $3 a head, though, mm-hmm. especially if you're paying a couple of nurses, paying rent, paying a light bill, and pay for your car and buy gas for the car. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of those.
You mentioned the modern office facilities. I don't think you told us about your first office facility here in Greenville, Dr. McConnell. Can you think back to that? What was it like?
Well, it was a good office of its time. I joined Dr. Alan Taylor in practice of radiology here. And I'll remind you that Dr. Taylor was the first full-time radiologist in Greenville, North Carolina at Pitt County Memorial Hospital. Prior to that time, they had some circuit riders come by, mm-hmm. just like the minister, this church and that church and so on. Well, when Dr. Taylor finished his practice, he's from Greenville, so he decided to practice in Greenville. It's kind of interesting in that some of the doctors looked upon him as having an unfair advantage.
How's that?
In that he was working at the hospital all the time. So he had an unfair advantage, and he was there where he should have been all the time, diagnostic x-rays and interpreting them. So the medical staff at that time, 1954, passed something to the medical staff indicating that all doctors practicing medicine at Pitt County Hospital were required to have an outside office.
Oh my goodness.
Build an outside office. And the board of trustees of the hospital supported the medical staff and required Dr. Taylor to build an outside office, which is over on 6th Street, where mostly mammography is done there now. Mm-hmm. But it's not the same part, though, because that was built on. A lot of that office is unused at the moment. But so Dr. Taylor had to build an office to do x-rays in, mm-hmm. so that he'd have the same, provide the same level of care that the other practitioners did. They also had an x-ray machine in their office. So they looked upon him at the hospital as having an unfair advantage. So he ought to have to build and support and staff an outside office like they did.
I see.
He didn't have staff this at the hospital.
Well, did the other healthcare providers, you said, do I understand correctly, they had x-ray equipment in their offices?
Some of them did, not all of them. But the ones that did, and they had the influence at that time, mm-hmm. Presented it in such a way that that Dr. Taylor had an unfair advantage. You know, he was in the hospital all the time. He didn't have to buy his equipment.
And equipment.
So he built the outside office, and it pretty much stayed dormant for a long time. But he did some studies there, but not a lot. But you were asking about my first office. The first office was sharing that office with him. And we had three x-ray rooms. And we did diagnostic studies, plain film studies. We x-rayed the GI tract, and we did chest x-rays, extremities, skull films, hands for arthritis, and one thing, the other, like that.
What was the staff like at that time?
Medical staff?
The health, who else worked in the office besides you and Dr. Taylor?
Oh, we had the x-ray technologists, radiology technologists, and we had James Tyson, the black man, who's kind of an all-around handyman that worked in the dark room for film processing. But early on at that time, they had hand process where you develop your film, put it up and then out of the solution. But they had processing when I got here. Mm-hmm. Machine that does the processing.
How have the safety accommodations changed in radiology since you started?
I think they're more stringent in keeping tabs on the dose of radiation you receive. Everybody wears a little film badge, exposed. And you replace that monthly. Everybody's required to do that, as a matter of fact. And you send these off, and they interpret how many Rankins or millirankins you receive per month. And if you get somebody that's way out of line somewhere, you know they're doing something wrong, so you kind of talk to them and find out what happened. Sometimes it may just be that somebody left their film badge in the room while they weren't wearing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Everybody's always worn red apron and gloves and so on. And even if they lived glasses, mm-hmm. where none of our guys wear them now, I think. I don't think I ever wore them.
And step behind the screen, of course.
Yeah, step behind the screen with the film being made, unless you have to be in the patient's room while you're doing fluoroscopic evaluation of the patient,
mm-hmm.
or you have to inject something while film being made, put a lead apron on. And the lead apron just mainly covers your thorax and abdomen. And maybe depending on how it comes in over your upper leg.
Protect the vital organs.
Protect the vital organs, that's right.
Yeah. Well, tell me, Dr. McConnell, you've had a vast experience in medicine. Two different careers, really.
Yes, I have.
And you have family members who are going into medicine. What advice do you give them?
I generally try to tell them to pick their area of practice that they feel like they can be happy with and do. Now, if they're like most of us, as we went through medical school, I was interested and happy with almost every specialty I rotated on. As you know, in medical school, you get exposed to everything. Mm-hmm. Try to get exposed. You're on service on surgery and pediatrics and medicine and urology and emergency medicine and whatever. So you get exposed to a lot of different things. So they need to pick an area of practice that they feel like they like in dealing with patients. And they don't understand it early on, but they need to pick an area of practice that they can have a life with and be happy with. When my daughter was finishing medical school, and she had married while in medical school, and her husband was also a physician.
Busy family.
Yeah, and they were talking about what they were going to do their training in after medical school. I mentioned to my daughter, don't overlook radiation therapy. Now they call it radiation oncology. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, just don't overlook it. I mean, a lot of times medical students don't get much exposure to it. And I think you should. I've had some exposure to it. I think it might be an area of practice you'd like. Well, anyway, she went down to the radiation oncology area at Wake Forest, and they have some elective rotations a month, but Rachel does here,
mm-hmm.
and they can spend some extra time on something. So she spent a month down there. After she spent a month, she signed up for another month. And then she went somewhere else to Virginia, maybe South Carolina, just to see what things were like elsewhere. I was doing an angiogram one day at the hospital at Pitt County, and Dr. Milton Rabin, who was head of the radiation oncology area at Wake Forest, I was in the midst of doing this angiogram, so I said, Dr. Rabin's on the phone, we'll speak to you. Ask somebody to monitor the patient in the catheter while I go speak to him, because he's a pretty important guy to me at that time. I said, hello. And he said, Bill, what the hell's going on with your daughter? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, she came down here and did some time and radiation, and then she came back and did it again, and then she ended with these other places again. Now she's down here wanting to talk to me about a residency.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what she did. She's a radiation oncologist now.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, it is.
Was there anything else you wanted to share about medical school history and your involvement with that before we close?
Well, I have very minor involvement, I think, but I think anybody that had any involvement with it from its beginning, should be respected as having involvement with the school, because while it was perceived as a need by some, it was also not perceived as a need by a lot of people. Fortunately, I think the need prevailed, and the politic of it got the center going. Mm-hmm. And being here when it started, it was such a small beginning, small classes, small number of faculty. I think it's very interesting, some of these faculty people they brought in were such good quality people and did such a good job. And whatever made it tick did, and it worked very well. I do think they have problems. The medical school has problems. The main problem they have, I think, is with funding. If you had adequate funding, you could organize a great medical school. We need to have some benevolent person with lots of money. I'm not talking about $1 million, but if they come forth with 50 or 100 million and fund a trust or something, that primary purpose was supporting this institution and what it does, I think it would be such a tremendous help for it. There's not many people in Eastern North Carolina that have that kind of money. But we need to have somebody to take an interest in it. If you could have a Bill Gates.
Yes.
His wife graduated from Duke University. So I don't know how much money they've given them, but I know that a year or so ago I read where they gave $25 million or something. Mm-hmm. But if you had somebody that had an interest in you like that,
it
could have, this is an area of the country that could be helped so much. And I do think that that's one of the things that that Mary and I feel so good about, Hope Lodge.
Yes.
That we've worked with that and we've helped some, and I feel good that they're going to put our name on it, because I think I've done pretty good work over the years, but I think I'd be prouder of that than almost anything I've done, because if you look at that, people are going to come in here with cancer to be treated. They can stay there free. I mean, that's a pretty big statement.
It's very exciting.
The people that need it, and it's, I don't know whether you've been by there or not, but if you drive by, do drive by and look, because it's going to be very impressive. Mm-hmm. Mary told me, I think they told her that the dedication, I think, is going to be May the 2nd.
Oh, wonderful.
So it would be a nice thing.
Well, I know that's very exciting for you, and the community is very grateful to you for...
Well, it's, you know, as I told somebody, you know, my children grew up here, they went to school here, they've gone to college, and most of whatever money I've earned has gone to take care of children and put them through school. All of them going through college, and two of them through professional schools. Well, three of them. Susan graduated from Carolina and then went back, got scientific background, and attended physician assistant school. Mm-hmm. She's employed at Wake Forest often.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But you spend most of your money on your children. Getting it. And the best thing you can give a child is an education. Mm-hmm. I think.
Well, Bill, my parents had shared your attitude, and I'm very grateful to them for that.
Well, my father was not a college-educated person, but he was well educated in that he read all the time. But he mainly read things like the Time magazine and newspapers, so he was well versed on what was happening politically. He told me that Nixon was crook long before I ever believed it. Because I was supporting Nixon.
Oh, goodness. But that was a difficult time.
Yeah, it was a difficult time. Mm-hmm. I still think Nixon was a good man. He just had a little paranoia, I think, that was not good. The thing, his downfall is so silly. the robber, the break-in of the Democratic headquarters, and then they're covering it up. Mm. They should have just admitted it, you know?
Yeah.
Plus, and he didn't do the break-in. He was just covering it up.
It's amazing, the little things that fate can turn on, isn't it?
Well, I think Clinton, he's ruined himself by his lying. He should have just admitted his thing, gotten it out open.
There you go. There you go.
I don't know whether you take read the USA Today or not.
Occasionally I see it.
That's what we do. We're on the road and so on. But I was reading one on the road the other day, and it's about a one or two full pages discussion about the terrorism and who is attributed to and mm-hmm. other half. This article took Clinton to task because they said he ignored it.
Mm.
He ignored it until it grew up and got worse. That he tended to ignore it because he was so busy with the Lewinsky scandal that mm-hmm. his all his time being consumed with that.
That's so unfortunate. That's
yeah, it is.
Yeah. Well, Bill, thank you for all you've contributed to health care,
well,
particularly in Eastern North Carolina.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you for the history you've shared.
Well, I wish I could share more with you. There are always a few incidents here and there, but I personally believe, and I may have told this to you one time before, I think we ought to, we, meaning the region, should lobby the legislature more for more money for this institution. I think the institution, the medical school thing, needs a new and comfortable and large clinical facility for seeing and taking care of patients. They also need to have, if you're going to be an academic institution, faculty members need to have some, if they're in academia, some research time.
Mm-hmm.
They need to have time to do it. Maybe they don't have to have a big lab, but you can do a lot of clinical research and you can do paper writings and so on if you just have time. How can you go to Morehead to speak an hour to a medical group down there when you work every day from 8 o'clock until 6, when are you going to write that paper when you put, somebody says, why don't you come down and talk to us about it? You don't just...
How can you do it?
You don't just walk down there and talk. You have to have some time to put stuff together.
That's right.
But,
I want to show you a model in the lobby. I bet you haven't seen it.
I don't know.
On your way out.
Okay. Is it about that?
It's about the expanded clinical facility.
Good. Mm-hmm. I do think they did need that. I would support that. You can see what's happening in other private areas around. Mm-hmm. They need to have something comparable.
Comparable.
That doesn't mean I'm against the private person, don't get me wrong, but I just think that they need to make it more up to date.
Sounds like good advice.
And a center of advice for the hospital, I mean for the institution, whether it be, quote, hospital or whether it be university, mm-hmm. a lot of people don't understand that, especially new people come, they think it's a medical school hospital, not the medical. They don't recognize it has to, you have to deal with two entities.
That's right.
But I think we need to emphasize cancer in the treatment of it, in the diagnosis of it, so on. You need to have a light in the sky somewhere or other. If you get cancer, you want to go to Carolina, East Carolina, and treat it or diagnose. So we have an area of interest already in heart and other aspects of medicine. You need to have that interest in cancer recognized enough so patients will want to come.
I understand that it seems to be somehow endemic. All over cancer instances increasing. But is it particularly...
I don't know the statistics on that, but it does seem that way. I think it may be. I appreciate it more because as you get older, you recognize older people. Of course, the older you get, the more likely you're going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Mary was reading something that we were driving along the other day, some article, I think when you're 60 years old, you have about a 60% chance of getting, if you haven't had it before, 60% chance of getting cancer. If you live to be about 80, you have about 80 or 90% chance of getting it. So we need to be aware of these things, and that means patients like that need to have checkup.
Yeah.
They need to have their colon looked at. What kind of cancers? Colon, lung, brain tumors are increasing. Breast. So these are things you can do to survey and check early.
Mm-hmm.
Get early detection. Gives you better chances.
Makes a big difference, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You hit it off the pad.
Well, Dr. McConnell, I'm going to stop and let you get your lunch now.
Okay. You mean you have to eat?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I don't want to hold you up.